dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The proposed treaty, misleadingly named the Free Trade Area of the Americas, the FTAA, has little to do with trade and is part of an ongoing process to create a social order where absolutely nothing is free. Every necessity and pleasure of life and all the functions of society will be operated for the profit of a small group of multinational corporate investors. In a sort of Orwellian newspeak, advocates of this process claim that it is a solution to poverty and inequality, and that it will increase prosperity for everyone. The reality on all counts, as you will hear tonight, is just the opposite. So-called free trade is the culmination of a process of enclosure of public space that one of our speakers on the program tonight, historian Ian Bowl, has called the Long Theft. In our first hour, we're going to hear a panel of seven speakers who will discuss the threat posed by the FTAA and the negative effects of its predecessor treaties on the workers, family farmers, women, and ecosystems of the nations where these treaties have been implemented. In our second hour, Professor Ian Bowl will discuss a new book, The Battle of Seattle, which chronicles the ideas, history, and social movements against corporate globalization.
During the last 2 weeks of March 2002, a select group of spokespeople representing labor, environmental, and agricultural groups traveled around the East Coast to engage communities in a dialogue about the Free Trade Area of the Americas. Labeled the FTAA public hearings, these meetings were held in 11 towns from Bangor, Maine to Providence, Rhode Island, and were sponsored and organized by a coalition of groups called the Alliance for Responsible Trade. The main goal of these hearings was to both help people see how the FTAA will affect them on a local level and to discuss some of the potential impacts of the FTAA for everyone in the hemisphere. Topics included the potential threats to labor, environmental, and human rights laws, trade issues such as tariffs, and the increasing power large corporations are having over democratically elected governments. In each stop along the tour, local representatives from social justice and environmental groups were invited to speak along with trade experts from Mexico, Brazil, and the United States. In the tour's only stop in Vermont on March 25th, Free Radio Burlington was on hand to record this diverse panel of speakers. Here we will listen to what each of the seven panelists had to say. We begin with Tom Hansen, Director of Grassroots Organizing for the Alliance for Responsible Trade, who discusses the impact of free trade policies in the U.S.
I'm here representing the Alliance for Responsible Trade. We're a coalition of 35 organizations here in the United States representing about 14 million people. We're the U.S. counterpart of the Hemispheric Social Alliance, which is a network of networks. Nearly every country in the hemisphere, all 34 countries, have a counterpart of the Hemispheric Social Alliance in their country. And we represent about 65 million people altogether throughout the hemisphere. And we're opposed to the Free Trade Area of the Americas. We were opposed to NAFTA. But we're not only standing in opposition, we offer alternatives. I'd like to start by trying to put the whole debate around fair trade into a context. There's a system that has been the predominant social, economic, political, and cultural system in our world, at least for our generation, for the past 25 years. In the United States, we usually call it corporate-centered globalization. In most of Latin America, it's called neoliberalism. I usually refer to it as the biggest ripoff in the history of humankind, the biggest redistribution of wealth from the south to the north, from the poor to the rich, that we've seen in the history of humankind. And it doesn't have any precedent. But I'd like to focus for a couple of minutes in international rules and regulations. There has to be a set of understandings between governments and between and among corporations about how this whole system is going to work. And those rules and regulations have to be, in order for this system to work, those rules and regulations, those agreements between governments and between corporations have to be at some level uniform. And that's where we see things like the NAFTA Accords, North America Free Trade Agreement. We see things like the World Trade Organization. If you take a look at any two governments in the world, and I just happen to pick the United States and Mexico here, but you could pick any two governments in the world. If you symbolize the country as a triangle with the richest 1 or 2 or 3% of the population up here and the rest of the people down here, these two groups in Mexico and the United States, and you, again, you can pick any country, have more in common with each other than they do with the rest of the people in their country. These two groups here have alliances that are class alliances, and it's often called the Washington Consensus, sort of misnamed the Washington Consensus, because it's a class consensus across borders. It's a class consensus that makes this group and this group rich at the expense of this group and this group. So we can say that part of this process of globalization is the globalization of class, is the development of this class consensus. That this neoliberal model, this corporate globalization model, is getting these two groups very rich and leaving the rest of us in both countries very poor. And that's where the FTAA comes in. The FTAA is part of this whole structure of agreements between the wealthy and the corporate elites and the government officials who have been bought by them. There are a number of elements of the FTAA that we're going to hear about in a couple of minutes from the other speakers, but I'd like to talk about what I consider the most fundamental one, the most problematic. And that's the threat to democracy. Democracy is fundamental. The ability of us to order our own lives is fundamental. And these trade agreements, and in particular the FTAA, is going to take away democratic rights that sometimes it's taken us generations to win. And I'll give just a couple of examples. Under the NAFTA Accords, there's a thing called Chapter 11. It allows for the first time U.S. corporations to sue governments. And we've seen this happen in a number of cases, and it has resulted in laws being overturned that were meant to protect us. A good example, there was a recent case filed where the UPS is going to be suing the Canadian government under the NAFTA Accords because they don't want to have to compete, or they want to be able to compete with the Canadian postal system. Now, what this is going to mean is that the UPS wants to move into Canada, take over all of the suburban routes, and leave the inner city and rural routes for the Canadian government to deal with, because they're the most expensive routes. They're the routes that you can't make any money on. The Canadian system is set up so that everybody gets equal postal treatment, but the UPS wants to set it up so that they can do what's called cherry picking, so that they can pick particular parts of the system, get rich off of it, and then leave the rest to the government. Now, this could very well happen to a number of different things. For example, education, healthcare, water, public utilities, things like public transportation. All these things are up for grabs under the FTAA. We've seen a couple of examples where environmental regulations have been threatened, and I think Sarah is going to talk about the environmental regulations. But all of these are fundamental threats to our democracy. And this to me is the scariest part about the FTAA, that corporations are being endowed with these rights and they're being taken away from us. Margaret Thatcher was the mother and Ronald Reagan the father of this whole corporate-centered neoliberal model. And Margaret Thatcher said back 25 years ago, she gave us TINA. There is no alternative. And the U.S. government and the British government and a number of other governments have been spending money like crazy to convince us that that's the case for 25 years now. Last year, in the U.S. economy, $1 out of every six was spent on propaganda to convince us of TINA. To TINA, I say ta-ta. There are thousands of alternatives. And those alternatives are being built. Those alternatives are being built right now. Whether it be cooperatives in the United States, whether there are a number of, I understand, small consumer cooperatives here in Burlington, whether it be the Zapatista Rebellion, whether it be the rebellion of indigenous groups in Ecuador. This Tata is being built all over the world. This whole neoliberal system is based on five fundamental values. And I think that they're values that I don't think most of us in this room would agree with. The values include competition, putting everybody in competition with each other, and the top dog wins and everybody else loses. Individualism. Individualism is kind of like our second religion in this country, maybe our first religion. Consumerism. Consumerism is the machine that makes this system run. Concentration of wealth, and we've seen that over the past 20 years. The rich are getting richer and the poor are getting screwed. And concentration of power. And I would like to suggest that any kind of alternative that we build would have five alternative values. Instead of competition, we need to look toward solidarity. Instead of individualism, we need to look toward collectivism. Instead of consumerism, we need to take into consideration environmentalism. Instead of concentration of wealth, an equitable distribution of wealth. And instead of concentration of power, and again, this is the most fundamental of all because it determines how we build everything else, genuine grassroots democracy.
Next, we will hear from Marceline White of Women's Edge, who discusses how women will be affected by the FTAA.
Thank you. I want to talk specifically about how the free trade area of the Americas is going to affect women's concerns and also social development issues. Now, you may already know that the UN said that women are 70% of the world's poorest citizens. So out of the very poorest, when we know that trade agreements affect poor communities, poor women are often going to be affected even worse. And there are a couple reasons for this. One is because of women's caring labor, what we call the care economy, women's work providing for their children and their families, taking care of the household, doing that kind of very important and valuable labor that is invisible in economic policies. It's an externalized cost, if you will, and it is invaluable. The United Nations estimated if we paid people for this labor, women would earn globally $11 trillion a year for all their unpaid work that they do. Now, when costs are cut by the government, women end up picking up that burden and doing double duty, trying to make ends meet. There are also social and cultural reasons. Throughout the world, women have less access to education, to equal decision-making within their home, to land, and to credit. So they don't have the same opportunities men have, even in an unfair trade game. And they're considered still secondary wage earners, which means that managers can pay women less money than men for the same kind of job, and women are the last hired and the first fired in jobs. We've seen throughout the world women earn less and continue to work in jobs where they have no opportunities to advance and in jobs that are considered feminine types of jobs in many communities. And trade agreements will just exacerbate that. Women's Edge has been working with more than 45 organizations throughout the Americas, throughout the hemisphere. And through this collaboration and critique, we've agreed that overwhelmingly we believe that women's wages will fall and their workloads are going to double. Now, Makrina is going to talk about agriculture and what happens when trade agreements like the FTAA promote corporate farming at the expense of family farms. One result of that is when family farms cannot compete, other members of the household have to go out and look for work. Oftentimes, that means women have to go out and find paid work if the family farm isn't paying. Now, one of these paid jobs is working on farms as paid laborers. In Colombia, Colombia is the second largest exporter of flowers to the United States in the world. 80,000 women work in Colombia picking and planting and cutting flowers for us to buy. Now, these women work with pesticides every day and certainly without any health or safety standards. As a result, there have been many miscarriages. Women have been prone to nervous problems, to asthma, and to a higher rate of cancer than in other places. This kind of export farming for cash crops has also affected the water table in the country because they've diverted water for the community to pay for water for the cash crops for the farming, and the water that's left has been found to be riddled with pesticides. The FTAA, as you all probably know, is negotiated by trade policymakers who not only won't meet with you today, they won't meet or hear from most civil society members. The trade policymakers are talking to big businesses quite frequently. They're allowed to meet in the same forums, but they are not listening to civil society groups, and their goal is to expand trade and not look at social and environmental issues. The agreement is between 34 countries in the Western Hemisphere and is going to be concluded in 2005. Now, the agreement affects many aspects of our lives. I mean, I briefly mentioned agriculture. As Tom mentioned, one of the areas that affects all of us is what is called services. And the FTA has a large section on services. And when you think of services, this means almost anything you can't drop on your foot is a service. We're talking about healthcare, we're talking about education, we're talking about electricity, we're talking about water. And the free trade area of the Americas will allow corporations to buy and sell these basic human needs the same way they sell tennis shoes. It will basically look at things like subsidies, which help the poor afford healthcare and education, and consider these barriers to trade, because this does not allow the market, the invisible hand of the market, to set the perfect price. So these are considered trade barriers and could be wiped out. Now, we've seen when these things happen, women are affected particularly. With the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, as workers, when services have been privatized, women workers have often been the first people cut. When you think about good middle-class jobs for people, you think about nurses, you think about teachers, you think about medical assistants. And in Nicaragua, 70% of the first people fired were women when the government cut these services. This also affects people as consumers. Of course, we all need health care. We all need education. We all need water. It's a matter of life and death. And again, when you remove these subsidies, the rich won't really suffer, and the corporations will make a profit by marketing to the rich. But the poor will see their rates rise. And, for example, in Bolivia, where they've already privatized water, the water bills rose for the poor by 400%. One woman who was a mother of four saw her water bill go from $5 a month to $20 a month. That extra $15 was what it cost her to feed her family for a week and a half. So she had to make some very difficult decisions about how much to feed her family versus how much, whether to pay her water bill. These are not choices any of us should have to make. And the agreement is going to force many people to make these kinds of life and death choices and reduce the role of the state in providing for its citizens, hire it off, shove it off to corporations to do, who are really only interested in making a profit. Another area that it's going to affect are more local concerns. Again, Tom talked about democracy. And as citizens, we have the right to vote in and approve local laws and ordinances that support our values and our vision of how our state and our city should be run. But the free trade area of the Americas has a section on government purchasing, the way governments make purchases and decisions. And this agreement says that the only decision-making you should use when deciding who to hire to do contracts for you, who to hire for construction, is what the lowest price is. So laws that, for example, support hiring local workers from the city, laws that say you should hire or contract with women and minority-owned businesses, laws that say you should buy fairly traded products or environmental products, could all be challenged, could all be struck down because they could be seen as barriers to trade. They are seen as irrelevant because the price is the only thing you're supposed to use to decide. And, for example, I live in Baltimore, Maryland. And in Baltimore, they've passed a city ordinance which requires contracts of over $25,000. If you're bidding on a city contract of $25,000 or more, you have to subcontract or partner with a women or minority-owned business as much as possible. This ordinance could be struck down because corporations will say, well, that has nothing to do with trade. The only thing you need to look at is what the cost is, the bottom line cost. So we're talking about not only decisions being made that affect us in other places and affect us in terms of solidarity and affect the poor, but also fundamentally decisions that wrest away control from us, from local rules and policies that reflect our values as citizens in the United States. And we have visions, as Tom said, we have alternatives, and we've been working hemispherically to fight these kinds of trade policies that don't reflect the values of everyone in this room, and that reflect only the values of corporations and policymakers who aren't listening to us right now. We have a few years to work to make sure that they hear us, that they listen to us, and that they change these trade policies so that they reflect a vision of trade that we all believe in and that we all share, that represents our values, one that's just and sustainable and supports the majority of people in this country and throughout the hemisphere. Thanks.
Next, we will hear from Macrina Cardenas of Michoacán, Mexico. She is the legislative director of the Mexico Solidarity Network, and she will discuss how the precursor to the FTAA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, has affected Mexico. Translation here is provided by Tom Hansen.
Tonight I'm going to present some of the areas where NAFTA has affected Mexico.
Cuando se estaba negociando NAFTA,
when the Mexican government was negotiating NAFTA, one of the promises they made to the Mexican people was that finally we're going to be entering the first world. But the reality has been very different. The panorama, the real life that we've seen in the last 7 years under NAFTA has been completely different. The number of people living in poverty in the country has increased from 58.5% before NAFTA to 79% today under NAFTA.
Con NAFTA se prometieron fuentes de trabajo.
NAFTA promised new jobs. The reality is that while in the central part of the country we lost employment, on the northern border what they do is install maquiladoras or sweatshops.
Las maquiladoras. El salario en las maquiladoras es
The salary in the maquilas is about $15 a day.
La razón es porque se instalaron
they installed these sweatshops because of low wages.
No regulación.
There's no enforcement of labor laws. And these labor laws aren't enforced, even though Mexico has some of the best labor laws in its constitution in the world. These were labor laws that were won during the 1917 revolution.
Con la influencia de los movimientos sociales en Europa. Ustedes pregúntense por qué.
And before NAFTA, there were about 1,200 of these sweatshops along the border, and since NAFTA, we've seen that increase to 3,500 sweatshops along the border.
Esto es más o menos en el área laboral, en el centro se perdió.
So while these sweatshops were set up on the border, there were several million jobs lost in the interior of the country, and people were forced to migrate to the border area looking for work.
Migró hacia la frontera buscando en busca de fuentes de trabajo. En el área de la agricultura.
In the area of agriculture, the panorama is the same. In Mexico, there are three forms of land ownership: private property. Private property includes also small landowners, ejido, communally owned properties, and a separate class of communally owned properties.
Los pequeños propietarios.
The communal landowners and the small landowners generally grew corn before NAFTA.
Los ejidos eran subsidiados.
The ejidos, or the communally owned property, was subsidized by the government for the subsistence growth of corn. But in the process of privatization, these subsidies to ejido owners and small landowners were removed. As part of this whole process of privatization, there were also changes made to the agrarian reform law.
Anteriormente el ejido no se podía vender. Esto también.
So this is something. This is a social gain that was made during the presidency of Cárdenas some 70 years ago. The ability to have ejido land or communally owned land.
Y no se podía vender y esto daba cierta seguridad.
So these ejidos were owned in perpetuity by the ejidatarios, the communal landowners, and the land could never be bought or sold, and it offered a certain level of security because they always had their land. And when they introduced reforms to the agrarian reform law, the ejidos could then be sold. So they started to sell their ejidos, increased private property in land, and these small landowners were then expelled from their land.
Tampoco se sembraba maíz.
And the third reason that that people gave up corn growing and were forced off their land is because the corn market in Mexico was inundated with cheap imports from the United States.
fue inundado por maíz importado de los Estados Unidos, de agricultores subsidiados por el gobierno.
And paradoxically, this grain that went from the United States to Mexico was subsidized by our tax dollars to the point of 49 cents of every dollar.
Con NAFTA.
Before NAFTA, Mexico was one of the principal corn growers in the world, and now under NAFTA we have to import corn in order to make our tortillas, which is part of our basic culture. And so we saw this is what happened to the land. We saw the removal of campesinos from the land.
En el área del comercio, la modernización, grande modernización.
And as part of the modernization, in quotations, of the Mexican economy, the huge chain stores of the first world type arrived in Mexico. And they came and ruined our small and medium-sized producers.
Que también daban empleo.
And these were the groups that created jobs.
En este periodo.
And during the last 7 years under NAFTA, because of the bankruptcy of all of these small commercial owners, there have been about 1 million jobs lost from the Mexican economy in this sector.
Y quienes pueden disfrutar de este
and the people who can really enjoy the benefits of these huge chain stores is a very small percentage of the population, middle class and rich. And many times these chain stores were built in areas where they ended up destroying the environment.
En este momento, en el sur de México, en Morelos,
Costco Corporation is building a store in the state of Morelos, in the southern part of Mexico, and they're destroying a large sector of the environment to do so.
Como hace rato decía Sara.
So as Sara said before, the corporations and grand capital can benefit from this, but not people.
Con la ruina de pequeños.
So we've seen the ruin of small campesinos and communal landowners. We've seen the ruin of small commercial operations. And with the loss of jobs in Mexico, we've seen a dramatic increase in the immigration from Mexico to the United States.
Se abren las fronteras para las mercancías y los capitales. La ley es sobre.
And so the laws that control the borders are open for merchandise and money, but not for people.
En este momento hay.
Today in the United States there are about 8 million undocumented workers. And we've seen this number more or less double in the period of NAFTA from 1990 to the year 2000.
Entonces, este es el panorama que ha dejado NAFTA en
panorama that NAFTA has left in Mexico.
Y esto es lo que no queremos que pase en otros países.
And this is what we don't want to happen in other countries.
Hello, everybody. My name is David Kane. I've been working in Brazil for the last 6 years, and I'm working with a large coalition called the Jubilee South Brazil Campaign, which makes up part of the International Jubilee Campaign, which has been working on debt issues. But this year we're working on, more specifically, on the FTAA. We in Brazil really see the battle against the FTAA as the final battle. Many people are calling this the final battle, saying if we lose and FTAA passes, pretty much all of our struggles will be impossible, because our governments will no longer, as people have explained, will no longer be able to implement what we struggle for as popular movements. So it's a very, very serious struggle that we're taking on. I think we in Brazil, but really most people agree that Brazil is really a very key country in the struggle for the FTAA. That's for a number of reasons. Because first of all, the FTAA is very much aimed at Brazil. Brazil, after Mexico, who is already included in NAFTA, is the largest economy in South America. There's over 170 million people in all the economy that entails. But outside of the economy, there's also the question of water. Past wars have been fought over petroleum and oil, but the wars of the future will be being fought over water. And the Amazon Basin region holds about 30% of the fresh water in the world. So, and Brazil has the largest part of the Amazon Basin region. And outside of water, the Amazon is also the largest source of biodiversity, which is the future economy is biotechnology, pharmaceutical companies, and all of the base of that economy is based on biodiversity, plants, funguses, animals that are found in this region. Many Americans aren't aware, but the U.S. is placing a number of military bases around the Amazon, in Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, recently in Brazil, in a military base in Alcantara, which is near the mouth of the Amazon. So we're seeing a real focus by the American government on the Amazon region and trying to dominate that as much as possible. And the last reason really is that because Brazil is a political leader in Latin America. Most people feel that if Brazil signs on to the FTAA, everybody's going to sign on. But if Brazil doesn't, it's really not going to fly because Brazil is the key. So that being said, there's a number of reasons that I'm pretty positive. I really think we have the capability to shut this down. There's a few things happening in Brazil that are positive. First of all, the Brazilian government itself, which currently is a pretty conservative government, has been implementing all of these policies for the last 7 years to the T. But the Brazilian government itself has been the most hesitant of the governments in Latin America, really, to enter into the FTAA. There's a few reasons for that. First of all, Brazil is the largest trading partner with a number of countries throughout Latin America, and they feel that by signing the FTAA, Brazil would lose a large part of that to the U.S. Brazil would lose a large part of the exports and imports to other countries. They'd also lose some connections with European countries. Brazil exports a large number of agricultural products and minerals to Europe, which they also feel that with the FTAA may influence the relationship with Europe. Another reason is two pretty recent examples is the U.S. hypocrisy in terms of international trade. I don't know if recently, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, the U.S. Raised import tariffs on steel by 30%. And that fell like a big old brick around the world and really pissed off the Brazilian government. Just the whole idea that forcing everybody else to lower their tariffs, but meanwhile raising and maintaining American tariffs. The other thing that happened recently was the fast track in December, that was passed in December. In the U.S. Congress, they passed the fast track in the House, which gives authority to the president to do all the negotiations for the FTAA. And then later, the Congress can only vote yes or no after 20 hours of debate. But when they passed the fast track in the House, they said, sure, we passed the fast track, but these 300 items, the U.S. Congress will have last say. So once again, it's the whole thing like, do as we say, but not as we do. You know, we want free trade and unlimited trade for everybody except for these 300 items that we want to protect. In fact, about 2 days after the fast track was passed here, there was a motion in the House of the Brazilian Congress for Brazil to pull out of the negotiations just because of the U.S. hypocrisy. So even the conservative government is fairly hesitant to enter into the FTAA. Outside of that, we're having elections in Brazil this year, and the Workers' Party candidate, Lula, has a fairly good chance of winning. He's the perennial loser. He's lost 3 times, but there's always the fourth chance. So you never know. But the PT, the Workers' Party, has declared officially that if elected, that Brazil will not sign on to FTAA. We don't know if they're going to continue on that line, but up until now they're very solid on that. Another thing is this year will be a very hot year in terms of popular mobilization throughout Brazil. The MST, the landless movement in Brazil, which is the largest popular movement in Brazil, has been really pretty quiet in the last couple of years due to a really strong counteroffensive by the government. But this year, actually in the middle of April, they're planning dozens and dozens of land occupations and mobilizations through the country, as well as a number of urban organizations are planning urban occupations. The political atmosphere is going to heat up a lot in Brazil. And then lastly, more specifically to the FTAA, is Brazil, as part of a continental campaign against the FTAA, will be holding a plebiscite or a popular vote in September. We're planning the September 1st through 7th. And Brazil has the experience, the popular movements in the church in Brazil has the experience of holding a popular plebiscite about the debt in 2000, where over 6 million people in Brazil voted about the debt issue, 95% of whom voted to stop paying it, to break the accord with the IMF. So we're planning, with the experience of that plebiscite, we're hoping to we're thinking maybe 20 million and up votes in Brazil. And the plebiscite in Brazil is part of a continental campaign that was officially launched at the World Social Forum in February this year in Brazil. A dozen or more countries throughout Latin America will be holding popular referendums, popular votes about the FTAA, showing that there is no popular support for this thing. And from now until the votes, there's an extensive, enormous popular education campaign taking place in all of the countries of Latin America, as well as the U.S., as we're doing right here. I think there's a lot of reasons to be pretty positive. I think we have the capability. Other than just looking at the political situation in Latin America as a whole, you look at Venezuela. Hugo Chavez has said that Venezuela is not going to enter the FTAA. Argentina is in no condition to do any sort of anything right now. Ecuador is on the verge of social revolution led by the indigenous movements. And Cuba is working throughout the continent, mobilizing and educating around the continent. So there's a lot of good things happening throughout the continent. I think we'll be hearing a lot more about the FTAA in times to come throughout the year. Lori Wallach from the Public Citizens has compared the FTAA's, calling it it's like a Dracula, meaning the more light that shine on it, the more the people see what's happening in the FTAA, in NAFTA, the more it goes away because people won't accept it. So I think every person here, all of us here, really have the responsibility to tell people we need to shine light on this thing. Everything's being held secretly. All the negotiations are being held secretly. So it's our responsibility to spread the word, to participate in all the activities that are going on locally. I think we'll be touching on that now. But I just wanted to, on behalf of the Brazilian people, many people have said, you know, outside of Brazil is a key country, but the U.S. is even more important. The struggle here is very key. It's the U.S. that's pushing this thing. So just calling for a popular participation of all of us here to spread the word and participate in the mobilizations against this. And I think we really have the possibility to beat this. We were in Bangor the other day, and like I was saying, yeah, if you take away these little triangles of 2 or 3% of the population, it leaves really big trapezoids. We're seeing like these trapezoids around the hemisphere are really getting together. So I just wanted to say, like, trapezoids of the world unite.
Okay, so my name's Sarah DeSantis, and I work with ACERCA, Action for Community and Ecology in the Regions of Central America. And I'm actually going to focus on Mexico a bit when I talk about the environment, because unfortunately that has been the country most affected environmentally due to NAFTA, not to mention also economically and labor rights and all these kinds of things. Mexico has taken the heat on every single level the most. So free trade agreements. What are they for? Why do we have free trade agreements? To get rid of barriers to trade, right? I mean, it's barriers to trade make it hard for capital, for goods and services to move across borders, so we have to get rid of them. And those, you know, barriers to trades are tariffs, are laws that protect local economies, the environment, labor rights, workers' rights, human rights, healthcare. All those kinds of things get in the way of corporations' ability to make a profit. So before you can gain access to a free trade bloc like NAFTA, before you can get into the free trade area of the Americas, what your country is going to have to do is to rewrite many parts of its laws, because these laws are standing in the way of free trade. And as Macrina already talked about, the Article 27 of the Mexican Constitution, Mexico had to overturn 29 other laws or rewrite 29 other laws to gain access. So this is going to be happening throughout the whole Western Hemisphere if the Free Trade Area of the Americas goes through. Another big part is tariff elimination. So under NAFTA, all tariffs basically had to be removed. Either that was done immediately or within 5, 10, or 15-year increments. 15-year increments were for the most sensitive issues, which Macrina also talked on, which I'm going to expand on a bit, which is the issue of corn in Mexico. So you have all these Mexican and U.S. economists talking about comparative advantage in agriculture. Should Mexico be producing corn? No, they don't have the comparative advantage. The United States has the comparative advantage because we have the Green Revolution technologies. We have the pesticides. We have the insecticides. We have the chemical fertilizers. We have the tractors. We have the overhead sprayers. So we should be the ones producing the grains for Mexico. What Mexico should be producing is horticultural crops because they're labor intensive and they have cheap labor.
they can produce the horticultural crops for the North. So that's kind of the agenda, and that's how it's decided on the global free trade agenda, who grows what. And unfortunately, as Macrina talked about, corn is the essence of life in Mexico. Corn was actually given a 15-year phase-out period under NAFTA, the tariff. And they started something called the tariff rate quota. And that meant up to a certain amount, the U.S. could export corn without any tariffs. And once it reached that quota, they were going to have to pay tariffs. Well, the Mexican government never implemented that, and it didn't matter. Before NAFTA, 2 million tons of corn were exported, and now Mexico gets 6 million tons of corn from the United States every year. Most of you probably know that. What happens in the Midwest? What kind of corn is grown out there? Genetically engineered corn. Almost 60% in the Midwest is genetically engineered right now. So what is that going to mean? Genetically engineered corn going down to Mexico? Yes. Also because the European Union won't allow it in. So actually higher proportions of genetically engineered corn are going down to Mexico because other countries have bans on it. Many of you may have already heard this sad story that I want to talk about. It takes place in a place called Oaxaca in southern Mexico. And I was actually there for a few weeks, a couple of months ago, talking to campesinos there. So in 1998, Mexico banned the cultivation of genetically engineered corn because the birthplace of corn is in Mexico. They have thousands of varieties of corn down there, and they wanted to protect that. However, they forgot to not allow the importation of genetically engineered corn. So now, as we see, there is genetically engineered corn growing. Two scientists last November went down to test the indigenous varieties in Oaxaca, and what they found was that the indigenous corn has genetically modified organisms in it now. And then the government went and tested 22 communities, and what they found is that 15% of these communities have corn that's indigenous with genetically modified contamination of 3 to 10%, and one community having 35% contamination. Now, this is a direct result of NAFTA, because obviously the corn going down there has tripled since NAFTA. Now, if you talk, I got to talk with some representatives from the Secretary of Agriculture. If you talk to them, this is increasing biodiversity. Increasing biodiversity, it's entering new genes into corn, and it's going to be able to evolve. That's their line. Unfortunately, I think we all know that's going to undermine biodiversity. And not only that, it's ruining the historical process of evolution of corn in Mexico. When you have genetically modified or hybrid corn crossing with indigenous varieties of corn, those traits are going to be transferred, cross-pollinate to indigenous corn. And as most of you probably know, hybrid vigors, they lose their vitality every generation. So what we're going to actually hopefully not see, hopefully this problem can be solved, but this corn being less and less, being able to produce less and less. Of course, there's hundreds of environmental effects of genetically modified corn, and I just want to touch on one of the kinds of corn that's been found down there is called BT, which is actually it's an insecticide. It's registered as an insecticide because it has toxins that act as insecticide in every single cell. And we have no idea it's to ward off the corn borer up in the United States, but we have no idea what kind of other insects. It kills all kinds of beneficial insects in the soil and above ground. And that's just one more environmental effect. So I'm going to leave the corn issue there. There's international actions going on all over the world on this, so please keep your ears open for that. Next thing I want to talk about, switch gears a little bit, is something called, and Tom mentioned this, is the investor-to-state dispute resolution, which also is known Chapter 11 of NAFTA, and it's going to be in the FTAA. And what it does is it allows corporations to receive compensation if a law impedes their ability to make a profit. So if you have an environmental law that's in the way and corporation has to go around that environmental law and they can't make as much money because they have to go around it, they can get compensation fees from the government who has that law. So corporations and investors aren't actually signing on to these corporations, right? They have no responsibility to these free trade agreements. However, they're receiving protection under these free trade agreements. And what happens here is that countries don't want to pass strict environmental laws, because they might have to pay for millions and millions or billions of dollars to keep these environmental laws in place, or they actually overturn environmental laws. And I want to give you one example of how what's happened in Canada. MMT is a gas, and this went in front of the NAFTA tribunal. MMT is a gasoline additive that's manufactured by U.S. corporation, Ethyl Corporation. It's U.S.-based, and it's a lead substitute. Unfortunately, it also reduces the functionality of catalytic converters, and one of its ingredients is known to cause brain damage in children. Whoops. You know, this isn't something we want in our gasoline or the Canadians want in their gasoline, obviously. So Canada actually banned the importation of MMT. Whoops. Ethyl Corporation doesn't like that. What do? They sue for $250 million under NAFTA. And it was very obvious that they were going to lose. Canada was going to lose, and they were going to have to pay the money because, guess what? What side does the NAFTA tribunal always rule in favor? Corporation or the people? Can anyone take it? You got it, right. Every single case is ruled in favor of the corporations. So actually what Canada did was they overturned the ban, and MMT can be sold again in Canada, and they also paid $13 million in compensation fees to Ethyl Corporation for lost profits and bad reputation. So this is exactly what NAFTA has caused, the annulment of indigenous rights laws, which Macrina was talking about, the annulment of environmental laws. The last thing I want to touch on is something called Plan Puebla Panama. How many people here have heard of it? I just want to see how many. That's great. Okay, this is good. So PPP is a proposed development project that President Vicente Fox is pushing in for Mexico. And it's a development project that would extend from Puebla, which is a state right under Mexico City, all the way through Panama. And what it is this great superhighway that has railroads, has dry canals going from the East Coast to West Coast, Pacific to Atlantic. It has highways going that way, so east to west, north to south, this whole little crisscross of roads and superhighways, as they call it, five lanes. And guess what's going to decorate the sides of these highways? Maquiladoras. For any labor that happens to get displaced when they come into their town and rip their town apart, they can go work in the maquiladoras. And all of this is going to be ripping right through the indigenous heartland of Central America. So this is something we really have to look out for. It's literally going right through very large biological corridors. So, and the connection here with the PPP and the FTAA, lots of acronym soup here, is that the PPP, which is the development project, actually provides the infrastructure for the FTA to happen. What it does is it facilitates the movement of manufactured and agricultural goods between the region and up to the United States, out to Europe, over to Japan. Whichever route you want to take, it will help you get your goods there. And again, it's not going to allow people to get across borders. Except the people going to the maquiladoras. And I'm done. I just want to say thank you all for coming. And I encourage people to get involved with the Vermont Mobilization for Global Justice. We have two campaigns. One is working on the Free Trade Area of the Americas, and the other is Plan Colombia. Thanks, everyone, for coming.
Next, we will hear from Ron Morissette. Ron is a Vermont dairy farmer who is active in both the Family Farm Advocacy Group Rural Vermont and the National Family Farm Coalition. Here he discusses how free trade threatens Vermont agriculture and family farms.
I'm going to talk about what NAFTA has done for Vermont farmers. I want to say thanks to everyone for taking time out of your busy lives to be here for the forum tonight, and thanks to the folks whose hard work made this event possible. I grew up on a family farm in Vermont and farmed for 40 years. My son currently dairy farms in New York with his wife and children. I'm co-chair of the board of Rural Vermont and a member of the Executive Committee of the National Family Farm Coalition. Rural Vermont and the National Family Farm Coalition have been working on trade policy for the last 15 years. The North American Free Trade Agreement has been in effect for nearly 8 years now. During the debate over the approval of NAFTA in 1993, farmers were told by free trade advocates that they would benefit from the approval of the trade agreement. According to the proponents of the NAFTA agreement, U.S. dairy farmers would be able to sell dairy products to the Mexicans and also to Canada, thus improving the price they receive for their milk. The amount of dairy products moving from the U.S. to Mexico and Canada has not increased. The increasing standard of living that NAFTA was supposed to stimulate in Mexico has not happened under NAFTA. In fact, the level of poverty in Mexico has increased since NAFTA. Under NAFTA, the dairy trade deficit has doubled from $416 million in 1995 to $796 million in 1999. And by that I mean the deficit is that we import more dairy products than we export. Also, the cattle and beef sector has moved from a $21 million surplus in 1995 to a $152 million deficit by 1999. The cattle and beef sectors are important to dairy farmers as a substantial part of their income is from the sale of cull cows and bull calves. Before NAFTA, a large bull calf would bring the Vermont dairy farmer as much as $200. After NAFTA came into place, the price of bull calves has dropped to as little as $30 for a large bull calf, and cull cows have decreased by a large amount also. The main impact Vermont dairy farmers have been affected by since NAFTA came into place was the drop in the price for milk. I want to just clarify that a little bit, is that Vermont and New England dairy farmers have been protected from the full impacts of the low milk prices for the last several years by the Northeast Dairy Compact. However, the compact was allowed to expire by Congress in September. Milk prices received by Vermont dairy farmers have declined by $4 or more per hundred in the last 4 months. The reason the price of milk has fallen to such low levels is the use of imported milk protein concentrates to make cheese and other products by the major manufacturers of dairy products in the United States. MPC is shorthand for milk protein concentrates. MPC is made by a process known as ultrafiltration. The skim milk is pumped through the membrane and most of the water, lactose, and other solids are removed. The product left behind is mostly protein and is dried to a powder form. The protein level varies from 40 to 80%. And it's something that you need to be aware of is there's no standard of identity for this MPC. In other words, it can be very widely in the amount of protein, and it can also vary widely in composition. Most of the MPCs imported come from the EU and New Zealand. However, MPCs also are imported from other countries such as the Ukraine and Belarus, which are likely to be contaminated with radiation. The USDA or FDA do not currently have a system in place that ensures the safety of the imported MPC. The cheese made using MPCs is of inferior quality for taste and texture, as well as the risk of contaminated products in entering the food chain. And that's not just something I'm saying, because if you go buy Kraft cheese today and compare it to the cheese that they were selling a few years ago before they brought in the MPCs, it's not as good a product. Even somebody like me that's not a real connoisseur can tell the difference. It really is different. Processors are also importing huge amounts of anhydrous milk fat, which is 99% pure butter, and other butter combinations to drive the price of milk down here in the U.S. The FTAA that George Bush has made his priority is an expansion of the NAFTA agreement to every nation in the Western Hemisphere except for Cuba. Family farmers in Vermont and the rest of the Western Hemisphere would be driven off the land if the FTAA is approved. The environment will suffer, farmers, workers will suffer, and democracy is threatened by the FTAA. We cannot allow ourselves to become dependent on foreign nations for our food. Already, the U.S. is importing over 50% of our food. Every nation should have the right to establish its own food system. Food sovereignty for all should be our motto. And thank you.
Next, Jonathan Kassam of the United Electrical Workers Local 221 will speak about the impacts of free trade and NAFTA on Vermont workers.
I'm a rank-and-file member of United Electrical Workers, UE, which is a diverse union with membership in many different sectors of the economy. originally formed by workers in the electrical manufacturing industry, General Electric and so forth. But we also represent people in the public sector, service sector, education, healthcare, and many other places. So I want to talk about three ways that free trade agreements and the political agenda that drives it, neoliberalism, have affected our members and the communities we live in. Specifically, I will address the effect of plant closings as corporations close factories and leave town to chase lower wages, how privatization affects workers in the public sector and the services that they provide, and how for-profit corporations in the service sector take advantage of lower labor and regulatory standards to pursue the same kind of race to the bottom that is better known in manufacturing. In manufacturing, the case is pretty clear. We demonstrated that at the beginning. As Jack Welch, former CEO of General Electric, or Generous Electric, as we call them in the UE, famously explained, corporations would ideally like to have every factory on a barge, which they could sail to find the lowest environmental regulations, the cheapest labor, the most corrupt friendly governments at any point. Given the chance, corporations will shut down even profitable factories in order to make more profit elsewhere. And this has devastating effects on workers in the communities they live in. For example, take the case of the Stanley Tool Plant in Shaftesbury, Vermont. They shut down their plant about a year or two ago. Incidentally, this was the most profitable Stanley plant in the U.S. It made higher profit, per worker, per unit, or whatever, than any other Stanley plant in the U.S. But they closed it down in order to move work to Mexico, South Carolina, and China because they felt they could make more profit that way. And in fact, when they were hiring workers in South Carolina, they told them, don't expect to work here very long, because we're not going to, we're opening this plant to take advantage of tax breaks. We're not actually going to stay here to give you a career. So in Shaftesbury, Vermont, which, the massive metropolis that Shaftesbury, Vermont is, you have 250 people out of work. That's a lot of people with no comparable jobs available in the area. In fact, the company held a job fair in the plant, thoughtful of them. But none of the companies who came to the fair were actually hiring. So it wasn't really, all that useful. So you have 250 people living on unemployment, getting jobs at half the wages they were previously making, which are often part-time or temporary jobs with no benefits. And these people are not spending the money they used to spend in the community. So your restaurants, your hardware stores, and local business in general is suffering. The town and the school district are no longer collecting property taxes from Stanley Tools, so they have to cut music programs, lay off teachers, and raise property taxes on homeowners. UE Local 273, which is the union for the production workers in the plant, is no longer able, because it doesn't exist, to organize people to participate in local charitable activities, volunteer fire department stuff. And the people who are now shuffling two or three part-time jobs no longer have the time or ability to schedule parent-teacher conferences or meetings of the parent-teacher associations. People are stressed out about being laid off, and it causes tensions in the family. There's more alcoholism, more divorce, more domestic violence. I mean, there's the whole, and you see this in deindustrialized areas, throughout the U.S. And as a result of people losing their higher-paying jobs, the state of Vermont loses income tax revenues as people's incomes go down. And the result in the current political climate is pressure to cut precisely those social services which people need even more after they lose their jobs, mental health counseling, Vermont Health Access Program, and so forth. Now, public sector workers, in addition to being threatened by the sort of secondary effects of plant closings, are also threatened by the scourge of privatization. And privatization, while not directly enforced by NAFTA, other than sort of incidentally through Chapter 11, Tom Hansen was talking about with UPS and the Postal Service in Canada. But it is part of the same neoliberal corporate agenda and is, in fact, being written into the proposed FTAA under provisions about trade and services. To give you sort of a little local example, recently this very public university, UVM, tried to privatize its shuttle system. In a nutshell, this would have meant the 10 or so regular shuttle drivers who have full-time jobs with decent wages and good benefits, including free tuition for themselves and their children, probably one of the most important benefits of working at UVM, would have been out on the street. Most of the corporations bidding on the service employ only part-time workers, offer no benefits, have very high turnover, and needless to say, their workers do not enjoy the other benefits of a union contract, like a grievance procedure and so forth. Obviously, the students, faculty, and staff who ride the shuttles have concerns that the people driving them, know the routes, have a proven safety record, right? These are sort of the public concerns, which you just are not going to get from a private company that has an incentive to increase profits by cutting corners. Now, fortunately, in this little small example, we won. The shuttle drivers union, UE Local 267, Students and Faculty for Peace and Global Justice, the ISO, Student Government Association, Vermont Workers Center, and numerous state legislators mobilized the community, got 1,100 signatures on a petition, and took a group delegation in to visit the interim president, who wasn't too happy to see them. And UVM actually backed down on this, in this, you know, small little struggle here. So there's a happy ending to this story. And the shuttle driving will stay in-house, but if the FTAA were in place, right, the private bus companies who could have profited from this, Laidlaw Corporation and your other friendly neighborhood businesses, right, could claim that they were unjustly denied profits because of this decision. And then finally, I want to touch on briefly on a struggle that another group of workers in our union has engaged in recently, the 100-plus women and men who work at Berlin Health and Rehab, a for-profit nursing home in central Vermont. Members of UE Local 254, engaged in a bitter 18-month struggle to organize a union and negotiate a first contract in order to improve pay and staffing levels in the nursing home. And I won't go into all the details of that very long struggle, but one of the things, the sort of salient point here, we found out during the struggle is that Berlin Health and Rehab is owned by, and was purchased about 5 years ago by, a Canadian corporation called CPL REIT. Now, CPL owns a big chain of nursing homes in Canada, and over 90% of them are unionized, decent benefits, decent pay, and so forth. But over the last several years, CPL has been investing its resources not in improving care in, or let alone pay in it for its residents and workers in Canada, but in purchasing, buying up existing nursing homes in the U.S. And the reason for this is pretty simple. In the U.S., wages are lower, unions and labor law protection are weaker, and regulation of nursing homes is less stringent. So, therefore, U.S. nursing homes are a more profitable investment than Canadian ones. Berlin is so far the only CPL-owned nursing home in the U.S. to successfully organize, and CPL spent well over $500,000 trying to prevent that in fees to $300-an-hour lawyers from Connecticut, a really productive, you know, aspect of the economy there. So what you see is, right, this company has made its money, made its capital in Canada from the work of Canadian workers and money from the Canadian Medicare system. And rather than using that money to improve anything in Canada, they're using it almost solely to squelch workers in the U.S. I'm almost done. So, and as well as on, say, campaign contributions to Howard Dean and other sort of legislative attempts to prevent regulations. So what you see is that under a free trade regime, service sector corporations, even though they can't move the actual production, can move their capital from country to country, again, in search of the lowest labor and regulatory standards. So to sum up, free trade has been a disaster for Vermont workers in all sectors of the economy. These trade agreements are part of an overall corporate agenda to do away with anything that stands in the way of corporate profits, including labor rights, environmental regulations, and the very existence of public services. And this agenda threatens all workers. And this agenda must be resisted, and as our experience with the shuttle drivers at UVM has shown in its small way, resistance does work. Thanks.
This audio report has been produced by Free Radio Burlington. For questions and comments, email freeradioburl@yahoo.com. That's freeradioburl@yahoo.com.